Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
We continue on with All of It on WNYC. I'm Alice Stewart, live from the WNYC studios in Soho. Thank you for spending part of your day with us, whether you're listening on the radio, online, or on demand. We're really grateful you're here. So let's talk books. New Yorker staff writer Hua Xu always knew he was going to write about Ken. Ken was Xu's friend while they were students together at Berkeley beginning in 1996. They were different in many ways, the music they liked, the people they hung out with. Ken was sort of outgoing and extroverted. Xu was shy into zines and alternative music. But the friendship worked. They talked about life, history, sports, a smoke break here and there. This was all before Ken's life was cut short, after he was murdered in Berkeley after a late night party the summer before their senior year. Hua Xu has now written a new memoir called Stay True about his time at Berkeley, his friendship with Ken, but also about his relationship to his parents and his Taiwanese-American identity. Join me now to talk about the new memoir, Stay True, which is out tomorrow, is Hua Xu, professor of literature at Bard College and staff writer for The New Yorker. Well, it's very nice to meet you.
Allison, thanks so much for having me.
Your father first came to America from Taiwan in the 70s, spent time in New York and Amherst and Illinois, where he met your mom. As you were sitting down to work on this project, what were some of the stories from your childhood you knew you wanted to include, or observations about your parents you knew you wanted to include to write the memoir, Stay True?
That's a great question. You know, initially when I sat down to write it, I was so fixated on my own kind of teenage years, my own experience. Like, I didn't think about how the experiences of your family, the stories you hear growing up, really shape who you are and, you know, what you're capable of dreaming about. And so it wasn't until I was pretty far into the book that I realized how crucial my parents' sense of America, of their own trajectories, of the places we lived, had informed mine as well. And so I thought a lot about, you know, the music they liked, the things that they would do with their friends in their free time, and sort of how that had modeled some possibilities for me.
We've asked you to pick a passage to read, because I want people to hear. Your writing's beautiful, by the way.
Thank you.
Could you set this up for us before you read?
Of course. It'll become sort of apparent once I start reading it, but it's about this form of communication my father and I embarked upon once he moved to Taiwan. And I was very... My family were all pack rats, and so we were very lucky enough to keep these old faxes that we sent back and forth. And It was just sort of this fascinating chronicle of the conversations he was having with me as I was becoming a teenager. When my father moved to Taiwan, my family bought a pair of fax machines. In theory, this was so he could help me with my math homework. I was starting high school, where everything, from what instrument I played to the well-roundedness of my transcript, suddenly seemed consequential. A few years earlier, in seventh grade, I tested just well enough to skip 2 years of math, and I was now paying for it. I had peaked too early. In fact, I was very bad at math. Like many immigrants who prize education, my parents retained faith in the mastery of technical fields, like the sciences, where answers weren't left for interpretation. You couldn't discriminate against the right answer. But I preferred to spend my time interpreting things. The time difference between Cupertino and Hsinchu was such that I could fax my father a question in the evening and expect an answer by the time I woke up. My homework requests were always barked, urgent. Every now and then, I rewarded his quick, careful attention by interspersing the next set of questions with a digest of American news. I told him about Magic Johnson's announcement that he was HIV positive. I narrated the events that led up to the LA riots. I kept him up to date on the fate of the Giants. I told him about cross-country practice, made honest commitments to work harder at school. I listed the new songs I liked, and he would seek them out in Taipei's cassette stalls and tell me which ones he liked too.
That was Hua Xu reading from his memoir, Stay True. In these faxes back and forth, your father would often end with the note, well, what do you think?
Yeah.
How did you feel to be asked that by your dad?
You know, at the time, I felt absolutely nothing. I was a teenager, and I feel like teenagers are sort of contractually obliged to not take their parents that seriously, or at least not recognize these moments, you know, when they're trying to shape you, to encourage you. And it really wasn't until, you know, just a few years ago when I found these faxes, I realized how that was sort of this tick, you know, like my father would always end each fax, even if he was being stern or giving me advice, by asking what I thought about something. And it's something he still does today. He'll ask me these kind of impossibly philosophical questions about why people like sports. And so, you know, I think curiosity is a part of him, but when I was 14, I didn't really care. You know, I was just kind of like, I just need this math answer. And, you know, we could talk about the Giants as well.
Well, how do you feel about that question now?
Well, now I do it to my own child. And of course, he dismisses me. He's only 7. So I have many more years of this to come. But you know, I understand it so much more. And I've actually told my father recently, like, it was incredible how you'd end each fax asking me what I thought about something. And I didn't realize it consciously at the time, but maybe you did sort of help build my confidence. And he just sort of chuckled and said he didn't remember doing any of these things because he was so busy with work.
You mentioned Cupertino. A lot of the book takes place, your family's there in the 80s. And it's this toss-off line about a company called Apple owned a couple of buildings at the time.
Yeah.
And you point out how much Silicon Valley suburbs changed around this period, writing, quote, flagging businesses were remade by new waves of immigrants, while strip malls began turning store by store into crowded islands of Chinese food and the latest in asymmetrical hair art. What were the dynamics among immigrants at the time, between older immigrants from Taiwan, like your parents, and the newer immigrants who were coming from China in the 90s? How did that play out?
It's a great question. I mean, I don't think there's any real... a lot of the book is about these distinctions that are only discernible to the people, you know, who embody them.
Yeah.
So whether it was like me and Ken, or people who immigrated in the 1970s versus people who immigrated in the 80s and 90s. And so it was really just these tiny kind of manner differences in manner, or differences in sort of like how comfortable you felt, perhaps, you know, shopping for things or asking for help, sort of the sense in which, like, later immigrants didn't realize how hard it once was to find these groceries that my parents would drive hours for. And so, my parents and people of their generation would sort of scoff at, like, they don't understand what it once meant to get bok choy here. No real animosity, but just more of this way of, I mean, in my mind, just sort of projecting yourself against this sort of American backdrop and kind of seeing where different people land.
And you write about yourself. I was an American child and I was bored. And I was searching for my people.
Absolutely. I mean, I don't think boredom is something that my parents necessarily understood or wanted to feed into. You know, I think for them, boredom was, you know, they weren't sort of bent on productivity, but they were sort of like, there should always be something for you to be doing or learning. But, you know, I was very much just a typical child of the 90s, just kind of generically casting about for the ways in which I was different from everyone else, whether it was my parents, my own friends. And that's what college represented. You know, college is sort of this opportunity where you meet thousands of people, if you're lucky. Or, I mean, you don't meet them, but you're sort of, mm-hmm. you have this pick of these thousands of new people and you can reboot your personality. And that, I was so eager for that experience in 1995.
You attended UC Berkeley, historically known as an activist student population, and it's a central setting in this book.
Yeah.
When you sat down to try to capture that time, Berkeley in the 90s, what did you want to make sure the reader understood?
That's a great question. You know, I think it's hard sometimes for people to read about someone else's past and not feel as though they're being told that that past was somehow better or more interesting. So I didn't want the book to feel nostalgic, but I wanted a reader to understand, you know, for example, what it meant to be bored in 1997. You know, like, we didn't have the internet the way we do now. It's neither good nor bad per se, but, you know, boredom just forced you to do different kinds of things. And so I think there was this kind of meandering aimlessness to, you know, just driving around, looking for donuts, you know, smoking cigarettes. The texture of time, the sort of the rhythm of passing time, it just felt different. And that was something that I worked hard to try and capture, just those quiet moments of friendship and dorm life and kind of figuring out who you are.
You're also self-aware enough to know that you were a bit of a snob.
Other people made me aware of that too. So I would say the self-awareness came a bit later in life. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I was definitely, I was very intoxicated in the early 1990s, much the way like tens of millions of other people were also intoxicated by things like Nirvana, you know, Pulp Fiction, Dr. Dre. Like there were all these things happening that you felt like were going to remake American culture. And to some extent they did, but at the time you weren't maybe as cognizant of how generic a feeling that was, you know, how it was sort of being shared by tens of millions of people at the same time. But, you know, it definitely pushed me toward making my own zines, sort of going to kind of underground basement shows, just pursuing difference and kind of figuring out where I was by kind of painting myself into this corner. But as I write in the book, like as long as I could claim that corner, like I had no problem painting myself into it.
The name of the memoir is Stay True. It is out tomorrow. I'm speaking with Washu. He's a staff writer at The New Yorker, as well as a professor of literature at Bard College. This is his memoir. Let's talk about Ken. Can we talk about Ken for a little bit?
Of course.
You write that the first time I met Ken, I hated him. Initially, what was it about Ken that put you off, and then what drew you in?
You know, we just talked about how I was a bit of a snob, a bit of an elitist. I really think that I just completely misjudged this person who was in the same dorm as me. I was entering college. I was looking for people who were just exactly like me, you know, people who could really finish my sentences, who knew all the obscure references I was trying to make. And when I first saw him in the dorms, he just wasn't that type of person. In fact, he was the kind of person that I was hoping to escape by going to college, just someone who is, you know, into like mainstream things and sort of dressed well in a conventional way. He was in a fraternity, which was sort of the opposite of the kind of social scene that I wanted. But, you know, within, you know, half an hour of actually hanging out with him for the first time, I realized just how I had misread him, you know, and just sort of the differences. We shared so many similarities as well, just both being these like Asian Americans trying to figure out our place in the world. And over time, and particularly after we lost him, like I would reflect a lot on kind of the size of his dreams versus the size of my own dreams, sort of how I learned quite a bit from him.
That was my next question. What is something you learned from that friendship and from Ken that is still with you today, that's still useful to you today?
You know, it's something I've learned, but I wouldn't say I've implemented it as successfully as he did effortlessly, but he was just an incredibly open-minded and good person. And I think that was why he kind of tolerated my snobbery towards things he was into. Like I was constantly ejecting his tapes and making fun of the things that he was into, whereas he would just sort of eagerly ask me to, you know, make him more tapes of stuff I was into, you know. And there is a sort of self-confidence. There's a kind of cool to who he was that was not what I interpreted as cool. Like I thought cool was like being into things, but for him, it was more just a comfort in the world as well as the bravery to demand more of it. And these aren't necessarily things that came naturally to me. Like I was more of the kind of sarcastic kid in the corner through like making fun of everything and not risking disappointment by expecting too much. But you know, in the years since his passing, it's something that I've tried to do, but I wouldn't say that today I'm as good of a friend as he ever was when he was alive.
You tell a really funny story in the book about him asking you to take him clothes shopping. Would you share that story? It's a great
detail. Of course, yeah.
Detail.
It was the first time we actually met was when he asked me to help him buy some clothes. And I thought, you know, clearly he recognizes that I'm a much cooler person than him because I have all this like kind of interesting vintage clothing, like it's all polyester and corduroy. And so I took him to some vintage shops. I outfitted him in the most garish clothes possible and he was cool with it. Later, he revealed that it was like a 70s party and he just wanted to look as terrible as he could and that I had helped him succeed. But, you know, I had initially thought like, you know, this guy recognizes the intentionality behind behind my outfit. Maybe he's OK. But yeah, that was sort of the beginning of our actual friendship.
The story of Ken's death is so shocking. He was essentially kidnapped, told to get in the trunk of a car after a party one night, and he was murdered.
How did, at the time, as such a young man, being introduced to death, a traumatic death at that, a violent death, really affect you in the short term? And then as time went on, what effect did you realize it was having on you?
Well, that's, in the short term, you know, this was 1998, very different moment, I would say, in how like an institution, like a college, you know, this is not a critique of Berkeley or anything, but, you know, it's just a very different moment. I don't think institutions really knew how to handle that kind of trauma or grief. So, you know, my friends and I, we did our best in our own lives and for each other, but it was still very difficult. It still took years to ask very basic questions about like why we felt, you know, guilt or sort of with the nature of our respective forms of grief. I think for me personally, I coped that week by writing a lot. Like I started writing in this journal that I bought as soon as I found out I had to deliver the eulogy, and I became really fixated on the idea of writing something. At the time, I didn't dream of being a writer or anything. It was just sort of something to do to pass the time and be present, but not really be present. And so, you know, for the past couple decades, it's something I've worked on the side as a writer. And so I think that there's something about that act of trying to match something you're feeling or thinking with language that runs through everything a writer writes. But mm-hmm. in particular, it all felt like preparation to, you know, reckon with the mix of emotions that I feel about this specific past and Ken and the friends that we had in college in the 90s.
Was it hard to write about this?
It was, I think, one of the strangest things to realize as I was finishing it was that it was okay to feel joy and pain at the same time. It's not something that I intuitively understood, I think. But, you know, writing about the fun times we had, not just with Ken, but with so many other friends that I'm still very close with, it was a delight to be able to hang out with us. And I had to accept that that didn't diminish the loss, that didn't diminish the tragedy. In fact, this is why the tragedy was so deeply felt, was because we had these highs. And so, you know, some of it was actually so, I felt so much peace and so much joy writing some of it. And then obviously some of it was incredibly difficult to write and something that I've been steeling myself for like many years to be able to do.
My guest is Huashu. The name of the memoir is Stay True. It is out tomorrow. Huashu is a staff writer of The New Yorker and a professor of literature at Bard College. You really nail the 90s. This book. The sense of what was important in the 90s, what wasn't important in the 90s. When you look back, because some of the stuff wasn't important, that idea of like somebody's, what somebody dresses like or the music they like really tells you everything you need to know, and you could possibly not be friends with the person who likes Pearl Jam. When you look back at the 90s, what was something that maybe we did get right?
Huh, that's a good question. I mean, I think that, you know, like I feel like we were kind of on the internet. I mean, I had an email address, but this was still a moment when people could ask for like a joke email address from the school and they would give it to you. I do think that there was that, you know, at the time, I don't think we realized how great it was to have to live kind of part online, but like part offline. But, you know, there's a balance, I think, that allowed us to not step into too much of the world too quickly, which I think is much more difficult now for younger folks. Like I teach at a college, and I think you sort of step onto campus already knowing what everyone else is into, already having had these debates and arguments and conversations on like a Facebook group or something. I don't think we intentionally got it right, but there was that sort of sensation of understanding the offline world, but then sort of understanding the delights of the online world at the same time. That balance is something that's much harder to even comprehend now.
There's a lot of music in the book, a lot of music references, and you had described a time that a 13-year-old you heard Nirvana, Smells Like Teen Spirit, for the first time. What did that moment mean to you?
You know, it was my parents were very into music, which had the effect when I was a teenager of making music seem like terribly uncool. And so hearing something for the first time that I could choose, you know, just hearing this great song and thinking like, this is for me, this is mine. That was really important. I mean, I still think Smells Like Teen Spirit's a good song, but it's not the kind of song I need to hear anymore. It's just sort of more like, you know, a moment in my life that, you know, was also shared by something like 5 billion other people over time. So, but it was sort of that feeling of I have discovered something, nobody else knows about it yet. And I am sort of becoming who I want to be based on this choice.
The name of the memoir is Stay True. It is out tomorrow. My guest has been Hua Shu. Hua, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks. This is a total delight.
This one's for you.